It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
President Donald Trump's national security advisor has resigned. Retired General Michael Flynn turned in his resignation late Monday night amid reports that he had misled Vice President Mike Pence and others about his contacts with Russia. Flynn's resignation letter said he'd had numerous calls with Russia's ambassador during the transition. Flynn initially said he didn't discuss sanctions with the Russian envoy, but later conceded the issue may have come up. Earlier Monday, two people familiar with the situation said the Justice Department had warned the Trump administration about Flynn's contacts with Russia. On Monday night, President Trump quickly named retired Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg acting National Security Advisor. Kellogg advised Trump on national security issues during the campaign. Sandy Kozel, The Associated Press.
All right, that's how a lot of the problems in the Trump White House began. It was like 24 days after Donald Trump came into office. Suddenly, Lieutenant General Flynn, who had stood by his side, who was the only general serving under Obama who spoke out in opposition to the Obama administration policies, who was the only national security expert that actually called out the Muslim Brotherhood, radical Islam, and within 24 days, he was gone. And now the country's led to believe that he's some sort of a traitor. We're going to get back to that in a second. But then the next real twist of fate that affected our next guest happened a few months later. Let's listen.
So I just wanted to announce, we've been working all weekend, very diligently, very hard, that General H.R. McMaster will become the National Security Advisor. He's a man of tremendous talent and tremendous experience. I watched and read a lot over the last 2 days. He is highly respected by everybody in the military, and we're very honored to have him.
I'd just like to say what a privilege it is to be able to continue serving our nation. I'm grateful to you for that opportunity, and I look forward to joining the national security team and doing everything I can to advance and protect the interests of the American people. Thank you very much, sir.
You're going to do a great job.
All right, and therefore, then H.R. McMaster became a household name who took over the head of the National Security Council from Lieutenant General Flynn. It's all very interesting. We've talked about it a great deal, but no one has had firsthand experience like our next guest, because Rich Higgins went to work for the National Security Council as their strategic planning officer. He was there in the White House for several months advising on that council, and then unceremoniously marched out of the White House a few months later. And you've heard Rich with me before. Rich is an expert in political warfare. He served our nation faithfully and went to the White House to do that, I know. So I've asked Rich to join us this morning to talk to us about what he can say about what's going on inside the Trump White House and about the memo that he wrote that actually was the catalyst for his dismissal. Rich, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, good morning, Sandy.
I just want to know your own thoughts, first of all. I presented the firing of General Flynn as the first piece there. I believe that was the beginning of the fragmenting of the Trump National Security Team. Would you look to that as a turning point as well?
It was certainly a culminating point in the battle, if you will. But I think you can go back to as early as November 10th, where the president-elect traveled down to the Republican National Committee, and he had a meeting with them, and they kind of came to an agreement where they were going to lean heavily on the establishment to staff the administration. And Steve Bannon's interview on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago illuminated that for a lot of people. I had not heard that before, not in the detail that Steve gave us. And I think his term, the original sin of the administration, is about right. we saw early on in transition folks who had been supportive of President Trump being systematically excluded from positions, particularly inside the national security space, meaning the Defense Department, the intelligence community, and on the NSC itself. And it was quite a struggle to get in there. And having arrived in there, it was really kind of shocking to see so many folks from the Obama administration still in place, so many people defending the policy positions, the failed Obama policy positions that candidate Trump had been vehemently opposed to. And he seemed to be moving to a center that really didn't exist. If you believe the Muslim Brotherhood is some sort of a group that we should be working with, then the people that were inside the White House had really no business continuing to push that. And what you saw happen was anybody who adopted the president's stated positions from the campaign being systematically marginalized, and those people, household names like Bannon and Gorka, but then others, folks like Derek Harvey and Ezra Cohen, also being pushed out to the margin. So it was just an unbelievable experience.
It is an unbelievable experience, actually, for all of us. Those of us watching from outside the White House, certainly you personally, but I want to reiterate what you just said, Rich, because I did mention it, of course, when Steve Bannon was on 60 Minutes, but I will restate again that Steve actually confessed something that was a shock to many of us, and that was what you just said, that he signed off. He himself signed off on the notion that they should allow the establishment to staff the agencies, the White House. They staffed. I know that the Justice Department. I think if we were having a different discussion about what's happening at Justice, we would find that the hand and the pen of the Never Trumpers and the establishment who hated him so much, staffing and undermining conservatives who hold the positions that Donald Trump said he held, and that those of us that are conservative certainly partnered with him on. I think, the question, Rich, always is, and the mystery always is, how could President Trump, who so passionately presented those ideas on the campaign trail, could so broaden the path, but actually not even understand that he was partnering with those that were the enemies of these issues? How could that happen?
Well, I think there's a pragmatism that surrounds the president and his approach to management that is, it's the pragmatic approach to a business leader, in his efforts to staff up a government, I think he felt that having won the presidency, the establishment would fall in line to support him, thinking that the establishment, the institutional government, and our elected politicians, particularly Republicans, would follow the will of the people. And I think, what he had to learn the hard way, I think we're all experiencing it now, is that, his real adversary was the Republican establishment. In many respects, they were more dangerous to him during the course of the campaign cycle than the Democrats had been. And I think there was a fundamental failure among some of his closest advisors to recognize the nature of his own election, which I would classify as a counter-revolutionary election, where the American electorate, conservatives, if you will, but not even necessarily ideological conservatives, just Americans who understand America as an ideology, as an idea, as a belief system, as a set of values, and as a nation, we were tired of seeing the hard left Marxist drift in the Democratic Party and the globalist socialist drift that has infected the Republican Party. And that counter-revolutionary nature, had they understood that, they may have been a little bit more cautious about partnering up with those folks. And the question now is, having made this mistake, can it be fixed? And I don't know the answer to that yet.
Yeah, me either. But before we get off the topic of that original sin, as Steve called it, Steve Bannon referred to it, I have to confess to you, Rich, that while as much as I think I know about what's going on in politics in Washington, I also thought, I really did think that when he appointed Reince Priebus chief of staff, first I was distressed, and then I thought, you know what? That's probably a very good strategic move. He does need to bring in the establishment and work with them. I also, if you had asked me in those early days, I would have thought that they would have at least not. I would never have dreamed that they would have absolutely sabotaged and undermined him. And as you and I both know, reams and reams and reams of resumes of very fine people. Heritage spent months putting together potential staff persons for President Trump. Those resumes went in the garbage. And I'm amazed, actually, that you and Steve Bannon and Kellyanne even, and some of the others, Sebastian Gorka, actually managed to get through. I mean, honestly, how do you think you managed to get hired, given all of that?
I think it was direct pull from the West Wing, along with a pretty substantial effort pushing from outside. And as somebody who had been supporting President Trump since December of 2015, way back in the primary, the level of difficulty I encountered. I mean, I can't even imagine the frustration of people who, were just hoping to get in to make a difference. Not only did the Heritage resume portfolio get dumped, I mean, all the people that, submitted their resumes to the Great America Web, Great America, or I forget the name of the website, but we had, 50, 60, 70,000 resumes of people that had hoped to help the president bring America back. And, we saw the establishment just basically flush all that and go on with the business as usual approach, thinking that they were going to outlast him, outweigh him, maybe hoping that the Russia hacked the election subversion effort would take root. The whole thing has just been a surreal experience, and I think it's going to be a turn. Looking back 50 years from now, I'm hoping a revitalized America looks back at this whole election cycle as a turning point, in an awakening, if you will, of Americans who care about the country, trying to reclaim our heritage, if you will.
Rich, I think we're going to come back to the deeper issues and also to the paper that you wrote and that whole strategy to undermine, which I'm totally on board with you. Just based on what we're seeing, I don't know how you could deny that there's an effort to undermine this president and to turn this country on its heel. And we'll come back to that. But the National Security Council is always kind of a mystery to people because we have a Pentagon, we have a Joint Chiefs of Staff, we have what? We have DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. What's the National Security Council? What is their particular niche? And what are they actually supposed to be doing?
Well, I mean, the simplest way to describe it is it's a fancy name for a group of advisors that provides for the president staff support over these myriad complicated international foreign policy and national security issues. It's made up of people that are both direct hire political appointments and people detailed from the various departments and agencies that their main role is to provide for the president guidance on, what the various institutions' capabilities are. And, and really it's a mechanism for the president to drive his political objectives down into the national security apparatus. So, it's a relatively small group. While you hear the numbers that, there may be 200 to 300 people there, most of those people are actually administrative and IT and communications. There's probably actually only 70 to 80 people there who really make a difference in terms of establishing what U.S. government national security policy is going to be. And it's an important role insofar as the opinions and the thoughts of the individuals who staff the body are the people whose voices are heard by the president. And mm-hmm. so the old adage, personnel is policy, NSC is the best exemplar of that.
All right. We have to... Rich, we have to take a break, so hold your thought for a second. Rich Higgins,
sure.
Former member of the National Security Council, unceremoniously let out of the White House. And we're going to tell you about that in just a second, how that happened. Plus, we're going to talk about what it is that Rich wrote that was so objectionable to the establishment Republicans and to the Never Trumpers and to the Democrats that they couldn't stand to have him around. You need to hear this. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
They say the campaign against McMaster began in earnest after McMaster ousted the fifth of five controversial officials of the NSC who had been brought in by Flynn. Why Rich Higgins, a strategic planning aide who worked on the Trump campaign, was fired by McMaster is subject to debate. Some sources say he and others exemplify McMaster's view that Flynn hired unqualified, substandard staffers. But there's also the matter of this memo Higgins wrote, rife with conspiracy theories reminiscent of those in the fevered corners of the paranoid internet.
If you are on the McMaster side, you do not like this memo because you read it and you say, hey, is he talking about me? Is he talking about someone in leadership who may disagree with the president? Am I that guy?
The memo, obtained by foreignpolicy.com, purports to unravel a bizarre conspiracy theory about a coordinated effort between the establishment, the media, globalists, bankers, Islamists, Black Lives Matter, the ACLU, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the United Nations, cultural Marxists, and the so-called deep state or permanent government apparatus, all of whom, the memo claims, are banding together to delegitimize and destroy President Trump and prevent him from making America great again. Quote, for this cabal, the memo states, Trump must be destroyed.
To me, it was really a declaration of war on some of the choices for personnel that the president has made. This memo's message essentially was, hey, those that are perhaps generals or those that have been in the process, that's not your brand, that's not who you are.
The memo also compares Trump to Abraham Lincoln, casting Trump's struggle as a battle between good and evil. Quote, in the same way President Lincoln was surrounded by political opposition both inside and outside of his wire, in both overt and covert forms, so too is President Trump, Higgins writes. Had Lincoln failed, so too would have the Republic.
All right, that was Jake Tapper of ABC News, and you can hear the delight in his voice about Rich being fired, but I have to say, to each smirking remark he was saying, I wanted to say, yes, yes, so yes, a conspiracy. Does anybody not believe that there's some sort of an effort to undermine this president? It doesn't take a genius. It maybe takes an ABC reporter not to see it or willfully to deny that it exists. Rich Higgins is my guest. He was with the NSC for I'm not sure how long, Rich. How long were you able to serve?
I was only in there for about 4 months, Sandy.
Was there a fight constantly at those meetings? I mean, were you guys a constant? Okay.
Yes. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, more than anything else is that you know, the people who would articulate the president's position in these meetings was the one who was getting the odd looks. I mean, it was just very strange.
And actually, they did, I would say, it's safe to say that under McMaster's leadership, they have pretty much countered, I wouldn't say 100%, but I would say a good portion of the president's stated views, whether it's the troop increase in Afghanistan, whether it's the Iran nuclear deal, I don't know, you can fill in the blanks better than I can, but they actually, the NSC actually, under McMaster, has sort of been opposing the president. The president will say something publicly, and then they come out and implement policies that are the opposite. Is that an overstatement?
I think it's probably an understatement. I mean, even just yesterday, we had, you know, General McMaster gave a talk at the Institute for the Study of War, and in it he said, yeah, you know, we removed some people who may or may not have been supporting the president's agenda, you know, the sequence on them being they may have been supporting the president's agenda, and now they're now blocked, and General Kelly's not going to let them by. I mean, they're not hiding what they're doing here. The idea that this is some sort of a conspiracy is just nonsense. They're doing it right in the open. I mean, the conspiracy theory terminology is used to try and discredit me. I mean, I think the really telling thing is that for the folks like Carl Harvey or Ezra Cohen or myself who've been removed from the National Security Council, not one single mainstream media outlet has contacted any of us to hear our views on what's going on. I mean, and that in and of itself is evidence. I think where the president struggles maybe in this is, you know, he's got a coterie of advisors around him who, it's not just that they don't necessarily support his worldview, but I think oftentimes they see his worldview as somehow reactionary. And, you know, it's not simply that they're opposed to what he's attempting to accomplish. They see what he's attempting to accomplish as dangerous to their globalist, forever war. You know, I mean, the fact that we are now in year 16 in Afghanistan, year 14 in Syria and Iraq, I mean, it's just absolutely insane, Sandy. And the people who were asking the hard questions about this were the ones who are now, you know, being pushed out.
You know, I just this is not quite on point, but I just can't resist asking you, Rich, because I can't seem to find this out. The speech that Donald Trump made at the UN last week was, I thought, phenomenal. And I wondered how in the world that got through General Kelly, and who wrote that? Do you know anything about that speech? Because it sounded very much like Trump on the campaign trail. It sounded like very much like Trump with the support of Steve Bannon and the support of Rich Higgins. You know, I mean, it didn't sound like H.R. McMaster. Do you have any knowledge of that?
I think there are some folks inside who are still on board. I mean, you still have Kellyanne in there. You still have Stephen Miller in there. And there are folks who have survived the purges, if you will. And hopefully, and you know, I don't know this for a fact yet, but hopefully that speech is a reflection of the president returning to his campaign form, which is what brought him into power in the first place.
You know, General Flynn, we believe, was fired in part because he was trying to expose what had gone bad in the intelligence community. He was very vocal about that. And my understanding, Rich, is that he was viewed by the deep state that manifested in the intelligence agencies as really the enemy. It was quite a coup to get rid of him. And so you write in this piece that was so controversial, that was not meant for publication. It was a 7-page piece called POTUS and Political Warfare. And in this piece that you wrote, I don't need to tell you, but I'm telling others, that you wrote about this cabal, this group of people and collection of entities working to undermine the president. Let me just ask you first, Rich, your background. Tell us your background that makes you think like this.
My background is, I'm an Army veteran. I worked in the Pentagon, in the Justice Department, but the Pentagon for well over a decade. In an office that specialized in irregular warfare. And so, irregular warfare is, it's the nonviolent aspects of war, or nonviolent in terms of we don't shoot guns and drop bombs. But there's, the psychological warfare, the influence operations. There's a lot that goes into warfare that, the average person may not be aware of, but these concerted information campaigns is something I'm very familiar with. And I saw one being conducted against our president. And, I think the idea that this is some sort of a cabal, it probably is a wrong term that I chose in the memo. It really is folks who share an interest in seeing the president diminished. And more importantly, seeing his movement, which brought him into power, the MAGA movement, if you will, diminished. And my point was simply that there are people and entities and organizations with a real stake in seeing the president's movement crushed. Folks who are tied to the open borders, folks who are tied to the international banking cartel that wants to be able to wield U.S. power in furtherance of their interests. There are groups, and some more hidden than others, that just don't necessarily share the president's point of view. And I was, in the form of the memo, I was trying to make sure people understood that what the president was experiencing was actually a far more serious, situation than I think that than the campaign in the White House had really been taking it to that point. I mean, it should also be noted that I wrote the memo in a personal capacity and shared it with colleagues that I'd met during the campaign because I just didn't think they understood the nature of the political fight that they found themselves in. And I was trying to provide some context for them.
Well, Rich, it's true that people are broadly ignorant about this is something that people don't know. You know, I think about years ago I read the bio of Mao Zedong. And I mean, I'm not an expert on Mao Zedong or the Chinese Revolution, but I know a lot about it. But I think I'm probably unusual. And I remember reading that Mao actually went to Europe and studied with European communists and perfected their methods, went back to China, and through disrupting, using natural disasters, tragedies, union strikes, you know, did what Barack Obama did, which was stir the sores of all the grievances, turn people against each other, and then took power. That I remember. But you go further, because you know a lot more about this than I do, and you actually said that in regard to what you're seeing Maoist tactics. It's not like the people necessarily know they're doing it. Some of them do, undoubtedly. But Maoist tactics to defeat this president, what would those be? What would those be?
Well, when I say Maoist tactics, what I'm, you know, the title of the memo is POTUS and Political Warfare. People who aren't familiar with the term political warfare, you know, their thinking is Democrats and Republicans and local elections and things of that nature. That's not what I'm speaking about. When Mao speaks about political warfare, he's talking about the mobilization of masses of people based upon identity or cultural groupings. In the resourcing of those groups and groups of people in order to split society. And so, you know, when Mao talks about, he has this concept he calls mass line, which is bringing people into alignment with his movement. And at the same time he's doing that, he's trying to, on the other side, demobilize the target group or his enemy groups. And that's what I'm talking about. That is Maoist tactics that I'm speaking to. And we see it, you know, playing out today with the whole NFL debacle, where, you know, Nessa Tiab, the girlfriend of Kaepernick, is conducting a very successful influence operation with the, you know, the Black Lives Matter, which is a Marxist group. Anybody who doubts that needs to go and do a little bit of research. Stalin talked about creation of groups like Black Lives Matter and the Black Panther Party, etc. And we see them using these themes based upon demography and race in order to split society. And that is in and of itself a Maoist tactic.
Yeah, you know, let me interject. I'm glad you mentioned that, because Colin Kaepernick, I don't doubt that lots of those players for the NFL that are bowing the knee during the anthem, as ignorant and misplaced as that response is, haven't a clue about some of the deeper, darker entities that are pushing them in that direction and the reasons. And I think Kaepernick is not an innocent. He's not an innocent here. And I'm glad you mentioned his girlfriend. Is she is Muslim? Is she not, Rich?
Right. Well, she is. I think she's African American by birth, but then grew up in Saudi Arabia. She is herself a Muslim. I think her father is Egyptian. And, you know, and you see it where the Black Lives Matter is now partnered with the Council of American Islamic Relations, and, you know, where CARES director Nihad Awad has come out and said, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement is our matter. And so, you know, we see this leftist Islamist alliance playing out now in fulfillment of the wider Muslim Brotherhood objective, which is, you know, to destroy America by its own hands. And that's what's happening right now. America is being ripped apart. You know, where a national icon like the NFL is now being thrown in the trash, you know, due to these Maoist tactics.
You know, would you say, when you consider what you wrote in this memo, POTUS and Political Warfare, and you talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, you talk about a lot of things and all these entities working against the president, would you say that the greatest objection, the forces, McMaster, whoever, their greatest impetus and offense by your paper was A, your attack or revelation of the deep state and what they're actually doing, or B, your view of the Muslim Brotherhood and the dangers of Islamic penetration to the highest levels of government? Which of those two things, offense about the deep state or their protection, really, our blind, as our friend Andy McCarthy would say, willful blindness in regard to the Muslim Brotherhood? Which is most offensive to them, you think?
Well, to me, they're two sides of the same coin, to begin with, you said. I mean, the institutional government, you know, the Defense Department, the intelligence community, it finds itself since 2010 in a de facto alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood in many parts of the world. And you know, where the quote-unquote deep state, I mean, I don't like the term deep state just because it conjures up images of, you know, people in a smoke-filled room plotting. I think it's what I call it in the memo. It's the permanent bureaucracy. And I think the deep state now is a reflection of the long-term damage that has been done to our institutional bureaucracy, through the neglect of things like cultural Marxism, teaching American principles. I mean, we just an absolute postmodernist secular worldview that has taken over our general officers and senior leadership. And so we now have a generation of general officers, senior executives, who, you know, candidly, I don't believe they understand the strategic nature of their oath, and they don't understand how these, competing socialist experiments that they keep jamming into the Defense Department, you know, not only hurt our warfighting capability, but it damages the institution's ability to even be self-aware of what it is they're defending. As far as the Muslim Brotherhood piece of this goes,
Rich, we should have you hold that. Hold that thought, because we have to take this break. We just have one more segment left with you. You and I could talk to you forever, Rich. I really appreciate your experience and perspective, and I find it that it comports with what I'm seeing in D.C. So stay tuned. Rich Higgins is our guest, former member of the National Security Council and a national treasure, really. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
We begin this hour with newly released transcripts of two of President Trump's very first calls with world leaders. One of them is a conversation with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. According to the transcript released by the Washington Post, the president said, quote, "Look, I spoke to Putin, Merkel, Abe of Japan, to France today, and this was the most unpleasant call because I will be honest with you, I hate taking these people," an apparent reference to refugees. And in his call with Mexico's president, Mr. Trump urged President Enrique Peña Nieto to end his public criticism of the president's proposed border wall. Mr. Trump also reportedly said, quote, "We have the drug lords in Mexico that are knocking the of our country up in New Hampshire. I won New Hampshire because New Hampshire is a drug-infested den. So we have a lot of problems with Mexico farther than the economic problem."
That was a CBS report. Did you hear the glee in that reporter's voice? These are leaked transcripts of the President of the United States speaking with world leaders. She can't wait to get to the mic, and somebody inside is leaking those, and that is the status. I think that's status quo for what's happening inside the White House. Rich Higgins is our guest. He's a former staffer with the National Security Council, a national security expert, an expert in political warfare, which is what got him in trouble at the White House, by the way. Rich, how in the world could something like that happen inside the White House? The president having a conversation with a world leader and that transcript being released to the press without penalty, I might add.
What was amazing to me is more concern was given to nonsensical things like Mike Cernovich's Twitter account than was given to the leaked transcripts of the president's conversations. I mean, it was beyond absurd. And candidly, when you retain 40 or 50 Obama-era holdovers, several of whom worked directly for Ben Rhodes, what else do you expect? I used to use the analogy during the transition that we were going into Omaha Beach in terms of the Trump administration, that, you know, we knew the bureaucracy had largely been compromised by the Obama people. And, you know, the analogy I would use to describe the transcripts is, you know, we went in with Germans on the boats with us. I mean, it was just insane. And what shocked me was within the leadership, that there just seemed to be a kind of acceptance of this type of behavior that I just found it to be shocking. It looks like Attorney General Sessions has finally gotten serious about the leaking, but it was just unbelievable. Never seen anything like it.
I know. It really, and even in hearing that report, I'm shocked again, to be honest with you. In regard to your memo, the 7-page memo, POTUS and Political Warfare, in which you circulated privately, not part of your workload. You did this on your own. This is what you do. This is what you know. And so you got this memo that you had prepared to several people that you knew in the White House. You wanted them to know what you thought was going on in terms of undermining the president. And the question is, Rich, if it actually got to the president's desk. I've read that it did. I've read that it didn't. Did it?
I honestly don't know, Sandy. I mean, I've heard that it did. You know, if it did, that's great. You know, and I'm flattered, and you know, I hope he read it and understood it and acts accordingly. You know, and if he didn't, that doesn't really bother me. I mean, I know the folks from the campaign did read it, and most of their comments back to me were all positive, in helping provide for them kind of a context for what they're up against. And I think you see that now, where you know, Steve Bannon has left, he's taking on the Republican establishment. I mean, it's put us back on a footing that was it's more analogous to how it was during the campaign, where we realized we're going to be in a fight for everything we get. And if the memo served that purpose, that's great. The publicity that came with the memo after Foreign Policy somehow got a hold of it and leaked it, that's great too, because I think more Americans need to be familiar with these concepts like cultural Marxism and just Gramsci and some of the other things that I mentioned in the memo that will help explain what they're seeing if they take the time and do the research to get their mind around in the concepts that are being played out in front of them.
I actually read that Don Trump Jr. Read it and gave it to his father. His father read it and had very positive things. I can't be specific because I can't remember. Positive things to say about it, and then was told later by Sean Hannity that you had been fired and was furious. So these are things that I'm reading, whether they're right or wrong, I don't know. I'm curious about, really, very curious. I thought that General John Kelly was a different kind of person than it seems that maybe he is. When he was hired for Homeland Security, he seemed to do, you know, what President Trump asked him to do in terms of the orders to tighten up the borders and so forth. But then now that he's in the White House, Rich, it sounds as though he really is sealing off the information stream and that his proclivity is to partner with McMaster rather than some of Trump's earlier supporters who believe in the things he campaigned on. Is that true or false?
You know, I haven't spoken to General Kelly in years. I can tell you that, you know, he is a Marine. He's disciplined. He's process oriented. I'm very concerned by some of the things I see. And, you know, if these things are true, I mean, the stuff I see in the media, I don't believe it anymore, right? Where they're saying they're blocking his access to this. I don't know if that's true or not. I can say that, you know, General Kelly will do what the president tells him to do. He is a Marine. And the question really becomes, you know, what has the president tasked General Kelly with accomplishing? If that's normalizing, in quotes, the White House into kind of a standard bureaucratic thing, then you can expect it to become more and more institutional and reflecting the cabinet secretaries and the departments and agencies' wishes. If the president wants to, you know, conduct a true counter-revolutionary approach, this may not be the appropriate, you know, staffing structure. It really comes down to what the president wants to do. And I think throwing it at General Kelly isn't really fair. I know, you know, from my personal experience, I know that General McMaster doesn't share a lot of the president's views. And my concern is less that he doesn't share his views than his view of how the National Security Council works, where, you know, he sees it as sort of a boundary function where he tells the president what the left and right limits are and what the bureaucracy will almost allow him to achieve in lieu of driving down into the bureaucracy the president's policies, which is, you know, we've seen past presidents do that effectively. And candidly, we saw President Obama do that to great detriment, driving down policies that were in many cases very bad for the country. For example, the Arab Spring. So, you know, it really comes down to the president, though. The buck stops with him.
No question about it. I guess I always think, I think part of the equation here, Rich, just as I'm looking on from a further distance than you, is that the president's loyalty to his children has probably been the catalyst of this problem, because his son-in-law is a comes from a Democratic family. They're either apolitical or Democrats. And I think he has great respect. He loves his daughter. He brought his daughter and his son-in-law in, and they, I think, are they probably have favored McMaster and others who do not hold the same views as President Trump espoused on the campaign trail. I think part of this kind of boils down to misguided family loyalties. That's my thought about it anyway. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. Why Steve Bannon would be gone, why, you know, the people that were most faithful to the campaign, would he would allow them to be purged unless he's trying to sort of play the middleman with his own family. I don't know if you can comment on that, but that's kind of what I have surmised from a distance.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I share your concerns, and honestly, I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I can tell you that, you know, you never you never saw the people that currently surround him. You know, if you look at whether you're talking about Secretary Mnuchin or Gary Cohn or General McMaster or Jared, or, you know, you never saw any of those people on the campaign with the president. And, I think that that's the reflection. I mean, the contrast I've been using for folks is when President Reagan came into office, he was subject to many of the same opposition, right? Or much of the same opposition, many of the same opponents. But he had what I call the four horsemen around him, you know, when he had Bill Casey in there at the CIA. He had Judge Clark as his national security advisor. He had Ed Meese as his attorney general. He had Cap Weinberger as his secretary of defense. Core loyalists, all, you know, World War II vets, all who protected the president. And I don't see those people around President Trump protecting him. I guess that's what concerns me the most.
Yeah, I agree with you. I have to say, in regard to General Kelly, I felt that the fact that President Trump was able to deliver that speech, the one he did deliver at the UN last week, was actually a good sign. If General Kelly is holding such a tight rein over everything and reviewing everything, then he obviously that speech got through. And so that was kind of, in a strange way, one of the few comforts we've had in the last few months. Rich, we only have a few minutes left, but and this is a tough question for just a few minutes. You mentioned in your paper the effect of cultural Marxism. You mentioned the cooperation between the left and the Islamists. Can you just say a word about why that's happening and what you think the end game is for both of them?
Well, I mean, first off, I think it's really important that people recognize that this collaboration is very real, and it's candidly, it's decades long. I mean, in the memo I mentioned, it began in the 80s. I think, in fact, it began even earlier than that, where, you know, Saeed Qutb, the intellectual godfather of Al-Qaeda, his first book was called Social Justice in Islam. And really, it comes down to, at the core ideological level, your concept of God and man-made rights, where man's rights come from, right? And to Islam and to communist, you know, or Marxist, if you will, God is unknowable. And to the Judeo-Christian West or the Christian West, God is knowable. And it's at that ideological point the actual conflict begins. And we see, you know, whether you go to any university in the country or state planning boards or, at the interagency level in government or at the United Nations, or the Organization of Security Cooperation Europe or the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, these interacting narratives where, you know, the left and the jihadi groups are working together. And, you know, an example of that is, you know, this recent NFL thing where we see, you know, Black Lives Matter groups working with care groups, Hamas, here, you know, playing out right in front of our face. You know, in terms of how to deal with it, I'm afraid that the Marxist, the cultural Marxist, postmodernist, multiculturalist stuff, where, you know, the willingness to stand up for America and to be patriotic is, you know, now being cast as nationalist, white nationalist, racist. These are classic terms we've seen from the left. I mean, going back 100 years now to 1917, you can go back and look at testimony from folks like Bella Dodd to the House Un-American Activities Committee. And these smears, these put downs of, patriots, as somehow racist. It's a classic communist Marxist tactic. And we see see it played out today, and the jihadi groups are more than willing to slip in behind them and help, you know, push that narrative forward.
I need to say, I want to say, Rich, because you and I've talked before, and I don't think you'll mind me saying this. We have a lot of Christians listening to this show, and I am one, of course, and you are also. I know that doesn't what you lead with as a national security expert, but I do think that that enhances, in many ways, is the kind of the missing link in understanding what's going on in our world. You know, it is a struggle that goes beyond. It goes beyond just the descriptions that we give it. It's a spiritual battle. There's no question about it. And I do think that the differences in our understanding of God and who He is really the breakdown here. And it's creating enemies, even without people recognizing that that's kind of the center of their warfare. Rich, is there anything that you think, any word that you would say, as we have 60 seconds, as to what people can do? How should we think? What should we do?
I think the most important thing that Americans can do is, number one, inform their children about America. Number two is get active in your local educational system. Get involved in your PTA. Get involved on the parental council boards. Get involved in your state and local government. We have to become more active than the left is active in order to reclaim the country. And it's gonna be a long fight.
All right, Rich Higgins, and by the way, we'll put his paper, POTUS and Political Warfare, on our Facebook page so that you can read it for yourself. It's only 7 pages, and it's something that we should all know and have a grasp of. Rich, we will continue. I'm going to continue to pray for you, and I'll ask people to do the same. God bless you for your service, and we'll see you soon. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.